The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Chatham Baroque is a Pittsburgh-based trio that specializes in playing 17th and 18th century music on period instruments. The ensemble was founded in 1990 and has gone through a few personnel changes over the years. Today, the group consists of founding member Patricia Halverson, who plays viola da gamba, Baroque violin player Andrew Fouts, and Scott Pauley, who plays theorbo and Baroque guitar. Chatham Baroque maintains a very busy calendar of concerts and tours and musical collaborations, and they have some terrific CDs you often hear on Sunday Baroque. And I am so pleased to be speaking with all three members of Chatham Baroque, Patty, Andrew, and Scott. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello, thank you.
Hi. So I'd like to begin by having each of you give just kind of a quick description of how you started playing your instruments, because, you know, it's not like the orchestra teacher comes to your classroom in fifth grade and says, okay, who wants to play viola da gamba or theorbo or Baroque violin? You know, the path to these period instruments is often such an interesting part of that musical journey. So, Patty, why don't you go first?
Sure. I grew up in a family where all of, you know, I and all of my siblings played instruments, so I played the piano. But I have an older sister who was playing the recorder. And so, of course, one wants to emulate an older sister. So I started playing the recorder and got pretty serious about it and was playing in a collegium at a local college when I was in high school. And so I chose a college that had an early music program. And interestingly, when this was Brandeis University, and I transferred there, and the gamba teacher was really together, and the wind band teacher was a little less so. And so I just thought, I'll play the viola da gamba. And it grew on me, obviously. It's an instrument that offers a lot of opportunities, and playing a stringed instrument was just a wonderful experience for me to begin then and to keep studying.
Okay. Andrew, you want to go next?
Sure. Well, I also grew up in a family that played instruments, and in fact, it was a sort of mandate of the house that my sister and I play piano until we left the house. So I began piano as a young boy, and then at about 8 years old, I saw Itzhak Perlman on Sesame Street and was completely transfixed with the violin after that, and begged my parents for one, and they obliged. And so that's how I came to the violin and became pretty studious about it in high school, eventually went on to conservatory, and while I was studying at Eastman for undergrad, I met Paul Odette and Crystal Thielman, who ran the collegium there. And in fact, it's sort of funny that I didn't necessarily have too much awareness of early music at that time, nor the plethora of composers that there are in the Baroque that I was completely unaware of. But a friend of mine said, you should join the collegium. It's only one credit, but it's an easy A, and we have a lot of fun. And so I did, and almost instantly I was just transfixed and blown away by the amount of music that I was being exposed to by Paul and Crystal. And so impressed by that, and also just impressed with the quality of sound that period instruments produced. That next summer I went to Toronto to study in the first Tafel Music Baroque Summer Institute, and that sealed the deal, so to speak. I just heard my first Baroque orchestra live and was in awe of the sound, of the spirit, of the performance, of the people that I was studying with and their scholarship and individualism and how they really expressed music got me hooked.
That's great. And Scott, how about you?
Well, like my colleagues, I started pretty young, though not on the piano. I started on the guitar. And in first grade, I had started taking guitar lessons, playing Beatles songs and other things. I think my first ever recorded performance was me playing and singing Hey Jude. But I stayed kind of on that path through school, high school. I played some wind instruments, and then I ended up playing electric bass and then stand-up bass and, you know, kind of stayed in kind of a jazz slash rock slash bossa nova idiom for most of my young years. And then when I got to college, I really kind of was bitten by the classical bug, and I played the bass in the orchestra, started playing classical guitar. And from there, I think I studied with a teacher who was also an instrument builder, and he, this was at Pomona College in Los Angeles, Jack Sanders is his name, and he's still a great guitarist and instrument builder who, you know, introduced me to early music, and I eventually wondered what do all these pieces by Dowland and Vivaldi and you know Bach sound like on the original instruments. So I quickly went on to get a lute and a theorbo and baroque guitar, and it was kind of the rest of his history.
Wow! So you know you put it all together. For chamber music, the rapport between the players is such a critical element to good music making. And I want to know, how did the three of you meet? How did you get to this current incarnation of Chatham Baroque?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction, I'm the founding member, one of the founding members, the only founding member still in the ensemble. Emily Davidson was a founding member, and Jeffrey Stock. And so, you know, in terms of when we began this group, we had no idea that it would snowball into something that had such longevity. But, you know, we were fortunate. We started the ensemble in the early 90s, and there wasn't that much competition, and very little competition in Pittsburgh. And we had a lot of support from family members, and just, you know, Pittsburgh is a pretty culturally aware town, and so it just worked out, and we feel very fortunate as a trio, and I think in all of the different versions of this organization in terms of musicians, it's always been a very rewarding and full kind of experience, and that partly comes from just having a group where the members live in the same city. And so there's a lot of contact, and there's a lot of contact with the community, contact among us and with the community around us.
So being in close proximity was a very important consideration, because obviously there are a lot of orchestras and also chamber groups that have their members living, in some cases, even on different coasts or even in different continents.
That's right. And one of the things that attracted me to the ensemble, I came in 1996, was that they had already established themselves as a nonprofit organization, and they really had this goal of making it a salaried position, not something where you get paid by the gig. And that was very attractive to me, even though when I came, it was a very small salary. It was really just about, you know, a quarter of a salary, really. But it quickly evolved into something where I think now we can probably safely consider ourselves, other than maybe some ensembles that are supported by a university music department or a conservatory, that I think we're one of the few, if not the only ensemble that is a full-time salaried, we offer those positions, you know, and we have health insurance, and so we're really lucky in that way. Compared to some of our colleagues I know who are out there working every week in a different city, we have a certain amount of stability and ability to program our own music, work with really great guest artists who come into Pittsburgh and who work with us on tour. So it's an amazing setup, and I think part of that is Pittsburgh, and part of it is what Patty and her co-founders did early on to establish the group and have this vision.
Mm-hmm. And a good business plan, obviously. So you just mentioned something, and I really want to pick up on that, because you know, your core, of course, is a trio, but you regularly collaborate with other musicians. And I was curious to know, how does that come about? Do you decide, oh, you know, that's somebody we want to work with? You know, you hear about somebody or you hear a performance, and then you kind of find the repertory to fill in and make that happen? Or does the choice of music dictate which guest musicians you invite to come play with you?
I'd say it's a little bit of both. certainly we in our lives here in Pittsburgh, but also in our freelance lives, we and in our audiophile lives, listening to recordings and staying abreast of what's going on, reading Early Music America, we become aware of musicians or see and hear their work. And are inspired by what they may be doing or what their specialty or focus is or just by the beauty of their playing and consider that we may want to work with a particular artist and then conceive of a program. But I would say perhaps more often than not, we have music that, and repertoire that we each respectively want to do. And so at the beginning of each season planning process, we sort of come to the table with ideas, things that have sort of been in our back pocket for through the past season, things, ideas that we come up with, inspirations that we want to make manifest, and then think about who might, you know, fill the slots for the repertoire that we want to do amongst our friends and colleagues and people whom we admire and want to work with.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, in doing that, we want to achieve a balance. So if we have different singers for three programs in season X, then in season Y, we may have fewer singers. So we try to, of course, have variety from season to season so that it doesn't look like we're putting on the same show.
Yeah. We're really blessed with a huge variety of music in the Baroque, as I'm sure you and your listeners know. 150 years of music history is a very long time. And there's so much to discover and so much to play. And so we really want to showcase all of that, that breadth of music, this full spectrum of the Baroque to our audience and for ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a great point because as an ensemble, Chatham Baroque has always really typically played more of the less well-known composers and music. And, you know, I mean, if you look at your CDs, it's like Antonio Bertali and Santiago de Murcia and Giovanni Capsburger. So how do you go about finding and deciding on the music you want to play? Because, you know, you're not making yet another recording of, you know, the Brandenburg concertos. You're really digging and finding some more unusual names and repertory.
That's right. We do tend to focus a lot on lesser known composers, particularly of the 17th century, people like Antonio Bertali or Heinrich Bieber, Capsburger, the oboe player. You know, so some of it's somewhat dependent on the instruments we play. You know, Bieber is a favorite of violinists, so naturally Andrew's drawn to that. I'm drawn to a lute player like Capsburger. You know, and there are other pieces that we do that are gamba oriented. You know, by Erlebach, who's also not very well known, but he writes these beautiful trio sonatas for you know, violin, gamba, and continuo. Buxtehude does the same. So some of them are less well known. But you know, this year we actually did, for the very first time since I've been here since 1996, we did Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and it was really a blast. So you know, we have done some more horse composers as well. We've done a fair bit of Bach. We've done a fair bit of Handel. But I think for our recordings, of course, I think we tend to choose very carefully what we want to do. And often that's something that's maybe a little less known, that we feel like we have something to say that hasn't been already said, perhaps by other recording artists.
When we program our concerts, we like to expose our audience to lesser known composers, but we also sometimes feel that we need to entice our audience with more well-known composers. And so often we'll, you know, our motto is come for the Bach and, you know, stay for the Couperin.
Kind of. Right.
And so it gives somebody, some composer, it gives our audience a composer to latch on to that they're aware of, and then opens the door to their awareness of other composers that are in the Baroque.
I think the fact that our ensemble is quite small, I mean, there aren't that many trios. Usually it's a group of four or five, at least the groups that we are familiar with. But really that small kernel of three offers a chance for us to go in any direction. Mm-hmm. So we can be the core ensemble of a Handel opera, or we can, you know, it just gives us a lot of flexibility, mm-hmm. and that helps us with diverse programming.
Mm-hmm. I think you also, you make a really good point about sort of mixing it up, because I think that's actually something I try to do with Sunday Baroque. We have to remember that as much as, you know, we all know a lot of this repertory very, very well and what we consider, you know, the quote-unquote war horses, there is literally someone hearing this for the very first time every time we play it. Every time you have a concert or every time we have a broadcast, there's someone hearing the Four Seasons for the first time. And there's someone hearing this music, just as there's someone hearing that Bertali Sonata for the first time. And so I think it's, you know, it's important to not necessarily always think like a very experienced musician and really look at it as a potential listener. And how, you know, we want this music is good and these are greatest hits because it's good music.
Exactly.
And it deserves to be played, and it deserves to be played alongside some of these other lesser known composers in music, but they're not lesser composers, they're just less well known. So
true. Yeah,
that's a very savvy approach and a very savvy mission and a very savvy way of programming, I think. I would love to go down the line with each of you, and you can just choose who goes first. But I'd love to know if each of you has like a favorite composer, and both a favorite composer to play as a musician. You know, you referred to, you know, maybe liking Capsburger because of the guitar and lute connection versus, you know, liking an Erlebach for the viola da gamba. But if you have a favorite composer to play as a musician and a favorite composer to listen to, and I'm also dying to know what other music each of you likes to listen to. It doesn't even have to be classical or Baroque or early music.
Well, I must confess, I don't really have a favorite composer, but I do love to play chamber music, and I love that because I love to listen to the other players in the ensemble and respond to it. And so it can be kind of lonely to just be playing, you know, a solo Bach sonata with a harpsichord or something, but I really love that dynamic of being able to respond to the other members of the group so that it's always fresh, if you will, and different, and I find that really fun. I really like 19th century music, actually. I wouldn't say I sit at home and listen to it, but my husband and I have a symphony subscription, and we really enjoy that, going to symphony concerts here in Pittsburgh, and partly because it's just so different from anything I ever play with my own instrument. So it's again, inspiring and really interesting for me.
Yeah, I think like Patty, it's hard to put a finger on a favorite. I think my favorite often is like what I'm playing at the moment, you know. Mm-hmm. So 1 week it might be Handel, and then next week it might be Monteverdi or Bieber or whoever we happen to play. I mean, yeah, I have a certain affinity for the lute and theorbo composers like Robert de Vizet and Capsberger, who are the two biggies for the theorbo. But I really love, Dowland, and I love to play Silvius Leopold Weiss when I have time to do it on the Baroque lute. I think listening, I love to listen to a few of my favorite players play the music of Weiss and Bach on the Baroque lute. That's just to me like the pinnacle of music making. Somebody like Robert Bartow or Nigel North on that instrument is just like divine to me. Yeah, and I guess outside of the classical realm, I actually am kind of taken with jazz. I like to listen to that just outside, when I'm not involved in doing a classical project or a Baroque project. So, that's sort of where I am.
And Andrew?
It is definitely difficult to pick a favorite composer, and I love so much of the music that we play, whether it's English 17th century music, Purcell, and in fact, our next concert will be really focused on music of England to a large degree, and also some music of Italy. But if I were to pick one genre within the Baroque that I always come back to, I think it would be sort of 17th century, mid to late 17th century Austrian and German music. The Stilus Fantasticus, that was really... the proponents of which were composers like Heinrich Bieber and Dietrich Buxtehude and Schmelzer. And if I were to put a finger on why, I think it's just the richness of sonority that having a lot of violas in the band makes. These composers really wrote a lot of, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7-part string band music with as many violas as possible. And that the quality of that sound, of having that middle range so well represented, matching that timbre with the timbre of the violone or the viola da gamba, massive continuous section. The more you can have, the better. You know, organ, harpsichord, theorbos, whatever your budget can allow. And of course, you know, selfishly, the violin writing in that genre is really fantastic. These are composers that really pushed the limits of violin technique for the time. And so it's challenging and rewarding to play well.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I'm thinking about what skilled instrumentalists you all are, but you are all three also really music scholars. And as Chatham Baroque, you have this amazing outreach component for young listeners called Peanut Butter and Jam Sessions. Would you talk a little bit about how you approach playing for kids and why that is important to you?
Sure. We've been doing Peanut Butter and Jam programs for, I don't know, more than 15 years. And it was in thanks largely to a group in Cincinnati. And we saw a demo of their version of a Peanut Butter and Jam, and they talked about that program at a Chamber Music America conference. And we asked if they would allow us to borrow their idea. And they said, sure. So we've been doing it all these years since then. And we love Peanut Butter and Jam for a couple of reasons. First of all, it is, of course, important to inform and educate and delight the young audience that the Peanut Butter and Jam programs are targeting 2 to 5-year-olds. And so it's really a great form of outreach for us because, you know, the kids grow up and then we get a new round of kids. And so there's a lot of change in who we see, who shows up on a particular Saturday morning. But there's also, of course, the adults in the room. And so 2 to 5-year-olds don't come by themselves, or they're accompanied by their parents, by a favorite aunt, by a grandparent. And so those grown-ups get a fair amount of high-quality music as well. And they take a lot of delight in seeing their young companions learning about music. We focus on very, very basic kinds of topics and keep our playing excerpts fairly short so that the kids feel engaged and stay engaged. And there's also the component of interactive activities that we program in that help it run smoothly.
Talk about hearing things for the very first time. That's one of the most satisfying aspects of Peanut Butter and Jam Sessions, is you walk out on stage and you've got a group of rambunctious kids that are running around the room, and to be able to draw their attention, which I think most of the time we really do, and we start playing, and just to watch that shift of being distracted and being amongst kids their age and running around and suddenly just tuning in. And the look in their eyes, sort of, of wonder or of hearing something for the first time, you know, they may not be cognizant of this music as a particular genre or historically informed performance practice. But it's very gratifying to see the response of young people to sound, to organize sound.
Mm-hmm. And probably also just those seeing people playing an instrument in person is probably something that a lot of people, not even just children, don't get to see all that often, if ever. And they're such beautiful instruments. They're so unusual looking, and they're so, you know, they're pretty instruments. They're probably pretty impressed by the theorbo too, if you ever bring that, right?
They are. Yeah, they often, I mean, we have something of a little instrument petting zoo at the end of every show where we kind of carefully carefully supervised, they come up and they can touch mm-hmm. and pluck a string or something like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, a lot of the kids are just fascinated not only by the theorbo but the others. But you know, and they like to see how tall they are compared to the theorbo and how many strings does it have. And you know, you show mm-hmm. them the wood on the back, and mm-hmm. you know that they feel the texture and they see the carvings of the sound hole, or they see Patty's head on the scroll of her mm-hmm. neck, and you know, they see the shape of the violin. You know, it's very tactile, and when they hear it and see it in person, I think it makes quite a big impression.
The other thing I want to mention about Peanut Butter and Jam that I really appreciate is that I feel that we create a very welcoming, comfortable, non-prescriptive, non-disciplined way of presenting music to kids. And I think that's very important, that some of their first impressions of hearing music and going to a concert, in quotes, is one in which they feel very at ease, where they feel comfortable, where they're not demanded to, you know, sit and stay still. Mm-hmm. And it's a natural experience, and they're free to run around, they're free to sing along, to dance, to wave scarves. And I think more than exposing them to the music, much more than exposing them specifically to whatever music we're playing or even whatever concept is, we're exposing them to the notion of coming to a concert as sort of an experience that's enjoyable.
Hmm. That's a really good point. And they feel welcome. You welcome them.
Exactly. Exactly. And we don't make any demands necessarily mm-hmm. of them, yeah. just that they have yeah. fun.
Complicated protocols, right? You know, when to clap, when not to clap.
Right.
What to wear. I love that. So what kind of future projects do you have in mind for Chatham Baroque? Are there plans in the works, or you know, things on your wish list? What's coming up?
Oh, almost too many to mention. maybe, should we start with Patty?
Sure.
We've been in conversation with Carla Boos, who's the artistic director of Quantum Theater in Pittsburgh, and they're quite a force, a very, very successful theater company. And we've done a project with Carla in 2015, and so she now wants to do Bajazet, and which is a Vivaldi opera. So that's coming up in about a year, or maybe a year and a half. So, you know, it takes a lot of planning to put on something of that magnitude, and so it's definitely not too soon to be having that sort of in our sights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've done a number of opera collaborations, not only with Quantum, but with Pittsburgh Opera, and I think there's a good likelihood we're going to do another Handel opera next year with them, although I shouldn't probably announce that publicly. But, you know, and then on our own concert series, we have plans, I think, looking at next year, we're hoping to do some of the bigger Purcell St. Cecilia Day odes, Welcome All the Pleasures, and Hail Bright Cecilia. And so that's an exciting, bigger size project than we often do with Chatham Baroque.
We really seem to be getting a lot of collaborative projects rolling all together with other arts organizations in Pittsburgh. And I think that's something our community really fosters. Both audience members and the funding community are really like to see arts organizations working together to produce projects that are perhaps larger than the scope of what any one of them could put on by themselves. Mm-hmm. So, and it seems like we're becoming, popular, and a lot of arts organizations are looking to us or reaching out to us to want to work together. Another project is with the Mendelssohn Choir that will be coming up in 2021. Doing Handel's Esther. I feel like we're divulging perhaps too much about future seasons for other arts organizations. But that's exciting to both plan our own series and things that we specifically want to do, just Chatham Baroque and present ourselves, but also realize that we have a lot of active partners in this community, both in our own discipline, but also in the theater discipline, the opera world, I guess that is our discipline to a certain extent, but with modern dance companies, we've done works before. We have another project in the pipeline doing Jean-Ferry Rebel's Les Elements with a modern dance company who would re-choreograph that piece, which was debuted in 1737 with Baroque dance. And that's an exciting proposition, too. And I think that Chatham Baroque's pipe dream right now is actually a brick-and-mortar one. We're really interested in the notion of getting our own space, both for our office activities for the administration, for our own rehearsal purposes, but also a place that's big enough and acoustically nice enough to be able to share with others. We can invite people for concerts at our home base, have a place where we can rehearse and then present as well, whether formal or casual, whether it's a fundraising event, a party, perhaps even we could host artist openings, you know, or I think having a visible space in which our organization and our brand is tied to a place that is in and of itself also very welcoming and a comfortable space is a dream that I think will take the organization to the next step.
It's really very impressive and very gratifying to see that kind of trajectory that you, as you collectively and you individually, you know, have passed, you know, that you're making these kinds of plans. And again, as I said before, it sounds like not just this really high-level artistry, but a really good business plan and a lovely supportive community and good communications and good symbiosis with your as you say, your funders and, you know, the various other stakeholders in your community. I congratulate you for that. That's a wonderful model and a very impressive thing in this climate when not necessarily every arts organization is having that kind of, has that kind of a pipe dream or has that kind of a plan in the pipeline.
Well, we certainly are fortunate to have a classical radio station in town as well that helps us get the message out tremendously, and we're very grateful for all of our friends at WQED-FM.
Absolutely. And the other thing that helps us a huge amount is that we have a really great admin team with Chatham Baroque. We have Donna Goyack, our executive director, has been making, you know, strides for us in leaps and bounds, it seems. And she's gone from being a one-person office now to having two full-time staffers, and now we're at two interns. So we have a lot of humans kind of working behind the scenes to help us fulfill our artistic vision and also expand our organization.
One thing, speaking of expanding, that's happened in the last year and a half is that we joined sort of missions of Renaissance and Baroque, which is a presenting organization. In fact, I believe it's the second oldest presenting organization of early music. We are in our 50th year now of presenting early musicians from around the world in Pittsburgh. And that's been very exciting, so that we can look at our season, both the arc of our season, both with what we want to accomplish and present ourselves with us on stage, and also who else we want to bring to Pittsburgh and showcase. And so, in effect, we really have double the amount of concerts that we present in Pittsburgh or events. And that's very gratifying.
It's very interesting to be kind of have, you know, as performers, to have now wear the presenter hat. And we're the people that, you know, other groups are coming to us now wanting to present concerts in Pittsburgh, and we can sort of shape that concert series and have a vision for it. So we're now planning our second year of concerts since the two groups have joined together.
Great. Congratulations. That's excellent. So Patricia Halverson, Andrew Fouts, Scott Pauly, thank you very much for making time to chat with me today and for, you know, sharing some of this behind-the-scenes information and sharing some of your exciting future plans. I wish you lots and lots of luck. Can't wait to hear what you have coming out for us next.
Thank you, Suzanne. And also thank you so much for your advocacy of Chatham Baroque over the years. It's such a treat to get a call from a relative on Sunday afternoon and say, "I just heard you this morning on Sunday Baroque." So we're so grateful for Sunday Baroque and for your support, and for that of WQED, of course, as well.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Suzanne.